Hello.
Hey. Welcome to Rosé and DNA, a brand new podcast about women who are making waves in science, healthcare, and tech. I'm Deanna.
And I'm Renee, and we're two professionals working in the field of genetics.
Today on the podcast, we'll be speaking with RNA biologist Dr. Bajoyita Roy. Dr. Roy grew up in India and got her bachelor's degree at Presidency College in Kolkata. She then traveled to the U.S. for her PhD, where she studied the regulation of gene expression at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. As a postdoc at UMass Medical School, Dr. Roy focused on the modulation of gene expression via mRNA stability and translational control. Since then, she has worked as a scientist in pharma, working on small molecule therapeutics for genetic disorders, and is now a senior scientist at the biotech company New England Biolabs. In her current work, Dr. Roy holds the important position of leading a basic and applied research group focused on developing RNA synthesis technologies to better understand the biological consequences of synthetic modified mRNAs, a technology that is increasingly important as time goes by.
So a couple of months ago, our paths crossed, and after speaking with you for some time, we knew that you would be an amazing guest, and we just had to have you on the podcast. And I think particularly right now, with all of the buzz around mRNA technology related to new potential COVID vaccines, we've just been very eager to talk to you and hear about your career and how it's changed, especially over the last few months. But before we get into all of that, we have some important business to attend to, which is discussing what we're drinking today. So I don't know if we want to just go around and mention what we're having.
I guess I'll start. So today I have actually a 2015 Sauvignon Blanc. It's from The Pairing, which is a winemaker out in the Santa Barbara region of California, which I prefer Sauvignon Blancs from California. I know some of my friends are much more the Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc types of people, but I'm a sucker for the California Sauvs. But the winemaker, when I looked this one up, said that I should be tasting some lemon curd, lime zest, and even grilled white peach, which I thought was a unique touch for this one. But from my first few sips, which I did take a few tastes before this started because I couldn't help myself, they did say it's perfect for the summer months, but I'm finding it very enjoyable and just pretending it isn't already November. How about you guys?
I can go next. So I actually have with me a Rioja today, and I have to admit, I'm not very picky and choosy when it comes to wines. I just try something that anyone has given. So this was sent by a friend for my birthday last month, and I decided I just, you know, open that bottle today.
Great. Love it.
Happy birthday.
Belated birthday. Thank you. Birthday.
Great. So today I wanted to do something a bit different, and I was in the grocery store the other day, and I saw a can of beer, but it was pink, and it said rosé on it. So I think I'm drinking a rosé beer, but it also says raspberry. I can't really tell. It's all written in Flemish, but it's called Hoegaarden. So I will let you guys know how it is. I haven't tried it yet.
Awesome. Well, sounds like we're all drinking some good stuff today. I'm just happy to be having an excuse to drink at 3 p.m. in the afternoon.
Anytime, right?
Exactly. All right. So I guess just to get started and to kind of dive into it, you know, we would love to kind of go back to your roots and learn a little bit more of the environment you grew up in. We know that you grew up in India and did some of your training over in the U.S., but you're actually our first guest who we've had on the podcast who grew up outside of the U.S., and I think we would love to hear a little bit about the environment you grew up in and how that influenced your career path.
Sure. It's always fun, you know, to look back and talk about these things. So, you know, I was born and brought up in the eastern part of India, Calcutta. And as a kid, my dad had a transferable job. So we would move every 3 years or so. But when me and my sister, we were in middle school, we decided, you know, it was time to settle down because every time we would move, we would have to learn a new regional language. Mm-hmm. And it used to get really tricky. So then we moved to Calcutta, and then, you know, that's where I did my undergrads, and then I moved here. And just to give you an idea, growing up, my mom had this mantra for us, and it was like, be independent and you will figure your life out.
I love that.
Yeah. I have to say that it heavily influenced a lot in our lives, definitely.
When you were in India, when did you first realize that you had an interest in science and considered the possibility of pursuing a career in science?
Right. You know, the education system in India is actually so different from what we have here. So you choose your area of interest pretty early, actually in high school. So it's very hard to switch interests later on and, you know, to take a break from the path you have chosen. So I decided to pursue my interest in science, mainly because of my teachers, my middle school and my high school teacher. And, you know, they played such an enormous role in shaping my career decisions. And even till date, like my professional choices. And I would say not just for me, but for a lot of my classmates, we are what we are today because of what we learned from them. So my high school teacher, like, she was the one who instilled this idea that, you know, science is not just about doing experiments in the lab. It is a way of life. And it's such an important lesson even today, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think I especially lately with a global pandemic, I think we're all considering how having an education in science really makes us privileged in that way to understand these things. And, you know, when you think about the general public, not everyone has that. And I totally feel that, you know, that science, having this underlying passion and understanding for science has really helped me in grasping what's happening all around us today, but with really everything that happens in life.
Yeah, I definitely think I was really fortunate to, you know, have that experience and that exposure so early on. And it was really important to have a role model, you know, someone who can inspire you in your day-to-day life. And, you know, I think a lot of my perseverance, my passion, I have definitely learned it from her. And I think that was one of the main reasons I decided to, you know, pursue science, because there was just so much to learn from her.
Mm-hmm. Were you always interested in pursuing a PhD, or was it something that you were just interested in science and you decided down the line that a PhD was the right choice for you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, actually. Like, when I first started off, you know, I liked research, I liked science, but I really had no idea where it's going to take me. I'm one of those people who likes to make a list for everything, you know, your pros and your cons. But I have a feeling that I never sat down and made that list when it came to deciding on your career. It was more of, you know, it just came, it just happened. And you know, I always wanted to do research, and I really enjoyed being in the lab, doing experiments. And I was also really fortunate to, you know, have people in my family, my sister and my brother-in-law, who were also scientists. So I kind of got an idea what it was to do research. But again, everyone's experience is really different. So when I decided to join, you know, graduate program, at that point, I just wanted to try it out and see what it is and just figure out if I liked it or not. I really did not have like a fixed plan that, okay, after my PhD, I'll do a postdoc and then this. For me, it was like, okay, I love it. I love my project. Let me just, you know, do it and see how I feel about it.
Nice. So kind of just like let the passion lead you wherever it takes you.
Yeah. Interestingly, that's how it turned out to me, but yeah.
And of course, it led you to the U.S. to do your PhD. And I think one thing that we would love to hear more about is when you decided to come to the U.S., did you experience any differences? And you kind of alluded to it before between your undergrad and PhD and postdoc. But were there major differences that you felt between the education system in India versus when you came here?
Right. You know, like I said, one thing is that you have to choose your interest so early on. And that was something that was really surprising to me when I first came here, because in my class, I had people who had taken break and they're, you know, from their studies, they had done something, worked somewhere. Then they decided that, okay, I want to come back to grad school and, you know, get a PhD. That was something that I had not thought that was an option. It was not an option for me at that point. But it's amazing to have that opportunity where, you know, you get a chance to take some time off, do something else, and then figure out what you really want to do. That was definitely, you know, one of the striking differences. And again, you know, there are courses where a little different. And somehow for me, I think I was really fortunate that for me, language was not a major barrier. But at the same time, I had classmates for whom, you know, they had to learn a new language right from the beginning, right? So these are things that that were really striking to me when I first came here.
Right. And even beyond language, I'm sure there were many other cultural differences. You actually did your training in Tennessee. And I'm curious what you experienced in Tennessee outside of your training that was different than your experiences living in India.
Yeah, you know, it was a cultural change, right? So like I said, I was in Calcutta. It's a metropolitan city with a population of maybe 15 million or so. So just, you know, small examples, like I had used public transportation throughout my life. That changed overnight there. I had to learn how to drive, get a car. And then I was like, okay. So, you know, that was a big cultural shock that you can't go anywhere. You have to drive everywhere. So that was there. There were a lot of other cultural differences. But again, the whole idea was to be in a place that's completely new and experience something different, right? But one thing that I definitely feel that made the transition really easy was that in basic science, you know, the graduate programs, they are really diverse. Like the graduate student population, it's a diverse population. So there are people from all over the world. It's an academic bubble, if you think about it. And I really enjoyed that. You know, you learn, you know, a lot of new things, small stuff. Let's say, you learn how to eat with chopsticks. I had never eaten with chopsticks before. You watch Korean drama. And these are things, you know, you meet people from all over the world and a lot of new things, but, you know, you just absorb everything like a sponge. And that was really fun.
I love that. Yeah, were most of the people that you were spending your time with once you got to Tennessee in your program, were they mostly people who were in your kind of academic bubble, or were you able to branch out and meet people elsewhere? I know that there's not much time in grad school to, you know, do much other stuff, but
I do agree with that. In the beginning, it was mainly, you know, your friends, your classmates and stuff like that. But, you know, grad school, it's you are there for at least 5 to 6 years. So you figure out stuff to do outside of lab. You have to. Otherwise, it definitely gets tricky. So yes, I did, you know, but I met them through friends. We would, you know, go out and then, you know, get involved in some of the community stuff. And I did meet some people there outside of work. And it was definitely, you know, it was a very different experience. But I'm so glad I had that experience in my life.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier that you had some really excellent mentors in your life. And I'm wondering, who were some of those mentors that were supportive for you? And how did you, you know, build connections and find mentors as you progressed in your career?
Right. So, you know, when I was a grad student, we somehow did not have that concept of having a mentor, like a formal mentor. It was not there. But, you know, you always look out for people who you somehow connect with. So I was really lucky that way. Our department was very tight-knit. And, you know, the labs were really small in size. And it was a really supportive program. So my lab was a graduate student driven lab, unlike a lot of other labs and, you know, other big universities where you have 20, 30 postdocs. So we were all grad students. There was a time when there were like 7 of us grad students, everyone from a different part of the world. And we all had, you know, different career ambitions. We had different backgrounds, but we were all going through some transition or the other at the same time, mm-hmm. right? Professional life, personal life. And I think that was the best thing ever. So, you know, things change around you. You're there for 5 years, 6 years. The only thing that's constant is your lab and your research program. Mm-hmm. So that was a big support system. And, you know, I'm still like, I keep in touch with those friends now because we have all moved on from that time. But, you know, people are in a different phase in their lives right now. But, you know, we had gone through that transition together. It means a lot to us. But at the same time, I also had a very, like, my program was, like I said, tight-knit, very supportive. I was really lucky to have my PhD advisor and my thesis committee members who actually believed more in me than I believed in myself. Mm-hmm. And even though none of them really mentored you, but now looking back, I realized that, you know, there was so much I learned from those day-to-day interactions and everything. It kind of shapes who you are today and helps you succeed.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that, when you entered grad school versus when you were finishing up grad school, how do you think that you kind of changed over that time as a scientist?
Yeah, I think, like I said, it's for a span of 5 to 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. I do think, you know, I really like research. That did not change. So that, I think that's the reason why I still do what I do. But at the same time, I think you learn from other people's experience. You see how things can be. And then, you know, you are at a better position to judge and assess yourself. I think that mm-hmm. was the main difference that I saw in myself from when I started off versus when, you know, I finished my PhD.
And, you know, when you finished your PhD and started kind of entering the working world, you know, well, we definitely want to ask you kind of about, you know, your different roles you've had. But right now you're working at New England Biolabs related to RNA technologies, which, as we said in the beginning, has definitely become a very hot topic in recent, actually days, since the vaccines have been developing and some of them have been announced for efficacy. When you were choosing your focus area for studying, did you ever imagine that, well, I'm sure you could never imagine that a global pandemic like this was going to happen, but did you ever think about the potential for these RNA vaccines and how widespread the impact would be on our communities?
You know, it's yes and no, right? I have been intrigued by the mRNA therapeutics field. Like, you know, as a postdoc, I started attending meetings focused on mRNA therapeutics, even though it was not something I was directly working on. I just wanted to know more about it. I deviated a little bit for my first job, but I still kept track of the field. And then I got the opportunity to work on it at my current position at New England Biolabs. I just could not say no. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the potential is huge. There's no doubt. And you can ask any mRNA geek and they would tell you that, oh, yeah, we knew the potential. Mm-hmm. But something that, you know, I don't think anyone anticipated was the pace with which it has advanced in the last 2 to 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, like, you know, and the other thing is people have been working on it, but it's just that till last year or so, we would talk about the potential of using messenger RNA as a vaccine. But because of what happened in the past 6 to 8 months or so, we are actually seeing it play out in real time. Mm-hmm. No one anticipated that. And it's just that it's a new technology. It's a learning phase for everyone. There will be trial and error, but at the same time, it's really exciting to see it getting tested in real time in a situation like this. You know, I'm thrilled. I have to say, I'm thrilled. And it's just, it's so hard to keep up with everything because, like yeah. I said, mm-hmm. the pace, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. And I think that's another thing for just the general public, especially people who aren't in science. Everyone is watching this unfold in real time. And I think it's giving the whole world a kind of a window into the scientific process, not just the triumphs, but also the failures of it. And I mean, at least in some of the conversations I've had with people, it's, I think, been very confusing for some folks to understand that how science works in real time. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you were to tell the lay public one thing about this RNA technology, what would that be?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting way of, you know, making vaccines right now, very different from the conventional method. However, you know, people, if you take a step back, look at, you know, molecular biology 101, where, you know, how the cell really works, it's really neat because what you're actually doing is making one molecule in a tube in the lab, and then you introduce into your body and you're hijacking your own body to make the actual vaccine. So it's really neat. And this makes it really lucrative as well, because all you need is a DNA sequence. You can make, as long as you have that sequence, you can make it in the tube and you can actually express anything you are interested in. So, so this is something that, you know, theoretically, it's, you can see that the potential is huge. But like you pointed out, that it's a simple idea, but you know, in reality, with anything, you have so many things that you have to take into account, specifically when you're looking at stuff like, you know, making a vaccine. It's a brand new modality, you know, people have not used it before. There are no approved mRNA vaccines in the field. So we are learning everything under such a crunch time, you know, the operation of it, the manufacturing of it. We are kind of starting from the scratch. The concept was there, and and people were working on it, but it's just all of a sudden something that normally takes 5 to 10 years, we are now thinking we will be able to do in 6 months. So you can imagine, like, we are literally compressing the entire process significantly.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what it means to actually compress that process as well, because I think that's something that I've heard concerns a lot of people. They're confused, you know, how is it possible that we can develop these vaccines so quickly? And I think, you know, that is something that the lay public would probably appreciate having some more clarity on.
Right. You know, like with the typical vaccine development process, you know, you can break it into two different phases. You have the scientific aspect, then you have the regulatory aspect, the manufacturing aspect. So the scientific aspect, again, you know, you have an idea, a concept, a research, a proof of concept experiment that has been done in the lab. But then you have to start testing it, right? You have preclinical testing, then you have safety and tolerability testing. That's your phase one clinical trial, where you do it in a small population. Then you know, increase the population size, then you roll it out to a larger population in your phase three trial, let's say. The thing is, you know, some of those works were done, but at the same time, when I say you are compressing it, what you're actually doing is you are doing these different phases simultaneously so that you can kind of save a little bit of time. You know, sometimes some people are doing phase one and phase two combined studies, phase two, phase three combined studies. But does that really compromise the process? No. Typically, you know, there's a lot that that is at stake, right? You know, you have to think about the financial aspect of it too. But now we do need a vaccine. All you want is a vaccine that works. So people are, you know, doing these simultaneously. The other aspect is the manufacturing. Sometimes you would not even manufacture a vaccine on a large scale till you see positive data. But do we have the luxury to wait now? No. So what people are doing is actually ramping up the manufacturing even before you have the positive data. Because if the data looks positive, you should have a vaccine ready that you can distribute. So these are the things that are done very differently. It's amazing. You know, like I said, on an average, I think it takes 10 years for you to develop a vaccine, but things are being done so differently from the regulatory aspect, from, you know, the manufacturing, the distribution, operations, just because, you know, we don't have that much time in hand, right? So does that help a little bit?
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely. I think that was a wonderful explanation. And I think it also, I do wonder if after this process, and if it unfolds really well, if that's going to actually change the way we think about these processes, right? Like, are we going to be able to use this as an example for how to push drugs and vaccines forward a little bit faster? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm curious if you think that that might be a trend we'll see.
I think, you know, this is a learning experience for everyone, right?
Yeah.
We did not anticipate these. And you know, that's the beauty of messenger RNA. I personally would like to think of it as one size fits all. So if you can manufacture one mRNA, you should be able to use the same facility to manufacture the second one. So hopefully that will boost the industry a little bit. But you know, sometimes for, you know, there are so many considerations here at this point. You know, these programs are being funded very differently than how conventional vaccine development is funded, right? So then you can't really afford to start manufacturing before you get successful data. So, but I am sure that, you know, the logistics are being worked out, and we will learn a lot. We will learn a lot from this process, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like everything has kind of been shaken up from what we're used to in every way possible. So it's I'm sure it's very interesting to be on that side of things.
Yeah.
But I just want to jump back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, about how you've sort of transitioned between all of these different roles working in academia and biotech and pharma. Can you talk more about your experience in each of these different settings? What did you like about them? What did you not like about them?
Sure. You know, as a grad student, I think, you know, at that time, it's hard for me to figure out what I really want to do, but it was really easy for me to figure out what I did not want to do. And that was something I knew early on as a grad student, that I did not want to stay in academia. And one of the main reasons was that I had seen some really smart people struggle to get funding for their labs and take decisions that I know they would not have taken otherwise. And I personally struggled to understand the whole point of, you know, like going through that entire thing. I know I love to do research, but at the same time, I just didn't see the point in staying in academia. And that really helped me when I knew that, okay, I don't want to stay in academia, but I really like to do research. So when I looked for my postdoc positions, you know, from day one, I made it very clear that my intentions are to move to industry. I don't know what I will do in an industry, but that was my intention. So that made my postdoc search really easy. And I also wanted to be in a place where I'm close to where things happen. Being in Tennessee, I loved my PhD program, but at the same time, I really did not have any exposure to, you know, what else is available out there. And you can only get so much by reading and, you know, doing stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, that definitely, you know, for me was a big thing to know that I did not want to go into academia. And when I was a postdoc, I fostered collaborations that would help me get closer to those goals, trying to figure out what I can do in industry, try to understand what you can do in industry, like biotech, pharma. And it is really interesting. I personally never had that dilemma that I want to go to industry or academia. But what I really, really found exciting, both in pharma and biotech setting, is the pace. I really like it. It's really fast. I really enjoy that. And contrary to what I had thought when I was a grad student or even a postdoc, you can really pursue basic research in both pharma and biotech setting. You literally do the same thing, write papers, present data, attend conferences. And personally, for me, it is really important that I get to do the stuff, like I said, that's relevant. I want to work on basic science, but something that's relevant. And I realized that you can do that in biotech and in pharma. So for me, you know, that was really satisfying to see. Like I said, I still do the same thing I think I would have done in academia, but, you know, and then the perks are a little different. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I think the perks are certainly pretty obvious to most people. But I mean, of course, there are benefits to, you know, each setting. I think we've even talked to people on this podcast who, you know, feel that academia is where they're meant to be. And so it's always helpful to learn everyone's perspective and why. Because, you know, what it comes down to is all of them are essential for us to succeed in science as a community. So
it's a balance, you know, right? And like I said, we heavily collaborate with academic labs because you need that. You need that balance.
Yeah. And did you, in your experience in academia and now in your time in biotech, have you noticed any differences in the ways that you've navigated those environments as a woman or as a woman of color in particular?
It's actually a very interesting question. You know, like I said, early on in my career as a grad student, as a postdoc, it was a little different. You know, like I said, the student population, it's so diverse, right? So right. I didn't think much of it at that time. But again, you can't really miss the fact that there are not too many women principal investigators. You know,
yeah.
I noticed that. We all noticed that.
Yeah.
It is a little different in industry, especially when you look into a more structured environment. You start to be the only one in the room who looks like you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how did I navigate it differently? I think for the most part, I am who I am. But I do consciously pay attention to the room more now than I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say have been the major factors in helping you decide where to accept a position? I'm curious if it were the resources or the community that an institution built that influenced your decision.
Actually, personally, I think for me, the driving force till now has been the science. So that's been like on the top of my list. Okay, I really know what I like to do. Mm-hmm. And if I really want to do it, you know, just figure out a way to do it. So I have prioritized that. But like I said, I'm a person who does make lists. So there are other criteria that are important to me. I would not say resources and stuff particularly, because sometimes it works a little differently in industry. But I would say that, yes, there are other attributes that I do take into account when, let's say, I decide, let's say when I had to choose a job. Let me give an example, if that helps. You know, when I was a postdoc and I was interviewing for my jobs, and there was a place where I interviewed, but I decided not to go for my second interview because I love the science, though. Of course, it was something, otherwise I wouldn't have gone for my interview. But during my first interview, I did not meet anyone who looked like me. To me, it's important. So it's not about resources or anything, but to me, it's important to see someone who has a background like me or who has the same kind of training like me, so that it just, I know it's not that straightforward, it's not that simple, but to me, it's important. So does that help your question a little bit?
Absolutely. And that's something that is important to a lot of students and trainees as they're choosing which program to attend. And we know now that a lot of institutions are actively working to make students feel that they're not the only one and to build an inclusive community. So it's really helpful to hear from your experience that this was a driving factor in your decisions.
And interestingly, you know, this is something that we don't talk about it a lot, but when you talk about it, you will see that it's not just you and I who think about it. To a lot of people, it is important, and it should be. Yeah. And, you know, I personally make a conscious effort. If, you know, I have to assemble an interview committee, you keep it so that the person who's coming, keep it in such a way so that the person who's interviewing feels part of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that we can all understand that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like your experience was you didn't have that, and that actually had an active role in why you didn't go to a second, you know, interview. So I think we should all heed that advice with whatever we're doing, whether it's hiring or, you know, forming committees to solve problems, all of those things. It's, you know, inclusion and representation is extremely important.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it's not easy, right? When you're a postdoc, you're looking for a job. I know a lot of people said, "Are you sure?" And I was like, "Yeah, because I really don't know if I'm going to fit in there." And what's the point if you don't know if you're going to really fit in that place?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you mentioned to us that having an Indian name has, let's say, shaped some of your interactions in the workplace and just in life in general. Do you mind speaking to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's my favorite one. You know, I do have a unique name, and even for Indian standards, it is not a very common name.
Yeah.
And I do understand that people get really nervous about it, saying it, because, you know, maybe I'll say it wrong, or sometimes, you know, they just avoid it. My last name, on the other hand, is really simple. So it happens that people just call me by my last name too sometimes. And it does shape the interactions. You know, it goes both ways. You know, on the other hand, I will also not forget this. So this is when I first came for my graduate studies, and my PhD advisor told me right before a departmental introduction, when someone had asked me, how would you like to be introduced? And he said this, and he said, you know, you will have to learn 500 names and maybe even more. We can all learn one new name today. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. And I still have not forgotten that. But, you know, that's the thing, right? I mean, it's not an isolated incident. It's really important. And the world is changing. We all have to do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are tools for this. So the other day, a colleague of mine actually called me on a Sunday morning and said, hey, have you checked this feature on LinkedIn? And I was like, no, what is it? He said, you need to click on it right now. So apparently LinkedIn allows you to record your name next to your profile, and people can play it and, you know, figure out how to say it. And she's like, you know, Bajoyita, no more excuses. People have to learn your name right now.
That's amazing. I didn't know they had that feature.
Yeah, it's so that, like, to me, you know, it's a big thing. It's not an isolated incident. A lot of people struggle with it, but I personally feel we should all make an effort to learn it, and that there are tools that are available. So, you know, why not?
As we've spoken about so far, you know, we know that there are some barriers that are facing women, that are facing people of color in STEM. And we would just like to know how you think that we can kind of move forward in reducing these barriers based on your own experiences and what you've seen in your career so far.
Yeah, you know, from my personal experiences, you know, the barriers you will have in the beginning of your career are going to be very different later on, right? Mm-hmm. But no matter where you are, what you're doing, it's really important to have a support system, you know, both at home, at work. It's really, really important to have someone who you can talk to. You know, those moments when you say, huh, it's not just me. Oh, you really think so? That's really, to me, that's really important. You know, what it really does is it helps you identify some self-imposed barriers that we all have. And that's the hardest one to overcome. But to hear it loud, it's really important. And, you know, like I said before, we all have different backgrounds. You know, there are differences there. We have people from diverse backgrounds. People's priorities and lives are going to be different. Their way of tackling the same set of issue could be very different. And sometimes there's no right, there's no wrong. It's just different. Our perceptions are different. So what really is important is that these differences are not overlooked, but like acknowledged at all levels. And, you know, I think that is something that would make a huge, huge impact, because as long as everyone feels that they're being heard, and you know, your differences are something that you will be proud of, and you should be proud of. And I think that's something that we should all actively try to achieve in all levels.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, creating communities for people to, you know, to share their experiences, but also making sure the broader community is aware and celebrating all of our differences is really, I think, a great perspective to hold, and what I hope we're moving towards with all of these conversations.
Yes. And that's why, you know, I, like I told you guys the other day, this platform you guys have, this is amazing. So,
thank you. You know,
it's just all you can hope is, you know, you say it loudly and one way or the other, you're just amplifying it. And all you need is one person to get, you know, to listen to it and you know, think a little differently.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that has been one of the most rewarding things, is just receiving even one message from someone saying that they feel that they've heard their own story on the podcast and they really appreciated hearing from someone else. And I think that has been honestly the most rewarding thing about all of this. So,
if you are tuning into the podcast, this is the spot where we typically would have a sponsor, which we have not at the moment. So if you are interested in sponsoring our podcast, we would be very grateful. We'll make sure that those proceeds go towards organizations that are supporting women, femmes, and non-binary folks in science. So before we get into our rapid fire round, let's do a check-in because we've all been drinking some new stuff, it sounds like. So, Pajorita, what would you say about the wine you're drinking today?
I actually really like it. It's very smooth, and I have to go back and check the bottle. You know, like I said, I'm not very picky and choosy. What I do is if I like something, I take a picture, and next time I'm in the store, I would just try to find it. But, you know, again, I forget, but I do like it.
Nice. Great. So a wonderful birthday present turns out to be.
I know. Yeah.
So this rosé in a can is definitely not rosé. I think it's beer that's raspberry flavored. It's very good, but it's certainly not rosé.
Not rosé.
But I would recommend it. It's excellent.
More probably like a sour beer than
kind of,
a
yeah, rosé. Actually. Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. But it's a pretty can, so.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
And for me, my glass is empty. I've been really enjoying it. It's really smooth. I would say if anyone likes a good California Sauvignon Blanc, I would certainly recommend it. I definitely will be buying this one again. So really happy
there
that I chose
go.
This one.
Great.
All right. Well, shall we do it?
Yep.
The rapid fire round?
I think it's time. All right. So the first question we have, if you weren't working in science, what job would you like to have?
Interesting. I have always thought I might be interested in graphic design. And that's mm-hmm. something I still feel that I can use my scientific background a little bit. I know I'm cheating here, but that's mm-hmm. something that I had always thought of.
You're actually not the first person who's said something creative like that to that question. And I think, I don't know what it is. It must be something about scientists who maybe it's, you know, exercising that opposite side of the brain. We crave it.
Yep. You never know.
Yeah. I mean, we launched a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So what is your favorite TV show?
Ooh. You know what? I watch a lot of TV, so I mm-hmm. would not say what's my favorite because it changes. Mm-hmm. I can tell you what I watched last. Sure. And, you know, we were all oscillating with the news cycle and everything. So I think this weekend I really wanted to get away from, you know, like reality. And I watched Emily in Paris, which is very, very unlike me, but I binged the whole thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, just watch it. I was literally, I have no idea why I decided to watch it, but I did binge the whole thing over the weekend.
I will say I also binged the whole thing maybe a week or so ago. It was excellent. I mean, it was horrible, but it was excellent.
Exactly. It was horrible. I had zero expectations, and I think I just needed something with zero expectations.
Yep.
And what is your favorite season and why?
Oh, summer. Always. Anytime. I would not even hesitate for a second. I grew up in India where, you know, with that. And so I like spring too, because I'm always, it's like an anticipation of summer, right? Mm-hmm. And I love summer. Anytime.
I was actually really curious what your answer was going to be, given that you grew up in India and now you're in New England where we got all of them. So,
yeah, you know, that was my main thing. But, you know, it's pretty when you're inside the house. But when you have to get out of the house, yeah, no, sorry.
Yeah. So with it getting colder outside and just generally our need for comfort in 2020, what would you say is your favorite comfort food?
I love mac and cheese. So, you know, so that's something that, I think if you have to ask me what's my favorite comfort food, yes, mac and cheese, anytime, any day.
It is the best.
Yes, same. All right. And if you could travel anywhere, obviously, if COVID restrictions were lifted, mm-hmm. where would it be?
Morocco.
Morocco. Ooh, yeah. Have you ever been there before?
Nope. That's why it's on the top of my list. So I'm really hoping that, you know, definitely that's something I'm really looking forward to. So that's on the top of my list.
Awesome. What makes you want to go to Morocco?
I have a friend from there, and you know, every time she goes home, she shows me these pictures and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just the culture. It's, you mm-hmm. know, the colors and it's mm-hmm. the music and it's so mm-hmm. lively. And it's just that I have this picture painted in my head. I have to go and see it.
One day. In these last few minutes, is there a particular cause or organization or piece of legislation that you'd like to tell us more about?
Yeah, of course. So this NGO is based in India called CRY, C-R-Y. It stands for Child Rights and Youth. It's near and dear to my heart. You know, we have the luxury, all three of us, that today we are having this conversation because we all got the opportunities, and that's why we are where we are today, right? But not everyone has that opportunity. So yeah. CRY believes that every kid should have access to this basic right and be in a society that is built on respect for dignity, justice, and, you know, equality for everyone. Mm. So definitely CRY and also Doctors Without Borders. I'm so glad you guys are letting me plug this one in. This is really great. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I think this is one of our favorite parts, actually, of the podcast, is just listening what people are passionate about and learning about new charities or nonprofits to support and, you know, get connected with. So thank you for sharing those. Yes.
No, thank you.
All right. Well, absolutely. You know, with that, you know, we just want to extend a massive thank you for joining us. This has been a lovely conversation, and I really don't want it to end, but thank you again for joining us and having a glass of wine.
Thanks for having me. And like I said before, you know, I wish the two of you all the best. And I really feel that this is a really important thing you guys are doing. And just let me know if I can help in any way ever. Okay. Just feel free to get in touch.
Oh, thank you so much.
If you'd like to nominate someone to be on our podcast, please reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram at RoseanneDNA or our website, RoseanneDNA.com.
And in the meantime, be well, be empowered, and cheers. Cheers.